Welcome to the Sydney International Guest Speakers Meeting held on the 8th of August 2021. Emotional sobriety begins when one adult child speaks with another adult child, sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Today, we are lucky and blessed to have Annie S. from New Zealand, who is coming to share her experience, strength, and hope, and her topic is interweaving the inner child and loving parent into the 12-step work. Annie has many years in and around the rooms of ACO. Please join with me in welcoming Annie S. as she comes and shares today. Welcome, Annie.
Thank you.
Annie.
Hi, Annie. Welcome.
Hi, Annie.
Hello.
Welcome, Annie.
Hi, Annie.
Hi, Annie.
Hi, Annie.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you.
Hi, Annie.
Hello. So many people from so many continents. It's wonderful. So, George, I'm happy to take it away, shall I?
Over to you, sister.
All right.
It's all yours.
All right. Well, you know, firstly, I would like to say there's actually a whole range of people I know here from all sorts of different continents around the world. And just that welcome that we had before where we all said our names, it for me is really important to know who I'm in the room with. I'm Romani Gypsy, and knowing who I'm with is really important. And I've seen some of you briefly on other things as well, like the Sydney Unity Day, where I felt really humbled to be asked to speak then, and also even more so today. So I'd just like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, New South Wales particularly, but all of Australia. For those, this is an Australian meeting and a Sydney meeting. And I'd also like just to open as a treaty partner in Aotearoa New Zealand, just do a little bit of a pepeha. So tēnā koutou katoa. Ko te atua, te piringa, ka puta, ka ora, tihe Māori ora. Ko Clent Hills, toka paimonga, ko Stourbridge Canal, toka awa, nor Black Country, West Midlands, England, aho. Ko Romani Gypsy, toka iwi. Ko Annie Southern, toka inua, ka nui, te mihi kia koutou. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou, katoa. So I would just like to say greetings to all of you. And that for me, my higher power is my refuge and has become something incredibly, really important to me. I came in as an atheist and you know, some years later now, I have a higher power. It's changed over time. I come originally from the UK and it's somewhere called the Black Country where the Industrial Revolution started. And a canal, therefore, is my river. We describe where our rivers are here in Aotearoa as part of our pepeha. And in my iwi, or my people, are Romani Gypsy, so Indigenous people who are left India in the year 1000 and moved across the Middle East and Europe. Annie S, and I have a brain injury, so I probably said my surname as well, but never mind. So just a general greetings to all of you, and I feel really honoured to be here. And I also want to acknowledge those of you who are in lockdown at the moment. I know there'll be quite a lot of you as well, so my thoughts are with you in that regard as well. And I feel quite honoured to go to be your speaker after Claudia B, who was someone in the very early days for me, was hugely important. I came into this fellowship on the 1st of December 1989. It's got a revolving door. I most certainly have used that revolving door over time. I found a lot to be dissatisfied. I didn't take any notice of the take what you like and leave the rest. It took me quite a lot of time to do that. But nevertheless, there was always somebody having a meeting somewhere, keeping this fellowship going. And there were days when it really dwindled down to being really quite small, this fellowship did. And now we are having a revival, the most beautiful thing. Sydney and what you're doing in Sydney and what you're offering is having a huge impact. So thank you so much for what you're doing, how it supports our people in Aotearoa, New Zealand as well, and how our part of the world is really becoming so strong in this fellowship, in this recovery. As I said, I've got a head injury, so I may do some word substitution. So that's a bit of a guessing game for you, just to make sure that if you don't like what I'm saying and you want to leave it, you can at least try to guess what I meant to say with my word substitution. A little bit of a game for you to do there. And I sometimes have internet issues, and we've got a bit of a storm going on over here in New Zealand. So if I go, I'm normally back within about 2 or 3 minutes. So it's time to get a cuppa or do something. So I just say, higher power's got it covered. So definitely take what you like and leave the rest. I have done almost all of my recovery outside of North America. So there's some wonderful stuff now coming out of the World Service Office that is being put together by people from all over the world. However, my recovery may just have a particular kind of inflection because it was done outside of North America, which was a very dominant force for putting out what recovery was for us back in the day. We had 3 identity papers, that was all, and everything else was audio recordings of speakers at things that were put on in North America. And we sort of hung on every word of those. And also chat rooms. I've done a lot of my recovery actually typing my share into chat rooms back in the day. And I've also gone to quite a lot of open meetings of AA just to hear a kind of similar preamble and be in the rooms in a similar way. So my recovery is quite checkered. So it's taken me over 30 years to get to where I actually think now with the literature that we have, the support that we have, that you could probably get this so much quicker. But for me, it was a long journey. And I went through probably a decade of being on the drama triangle as a victim, a decade realizing the whole perpetrator thing. But I'd been sneakily perpetrating from the position of a victim. So that took a bit of unweaving. And then eventually like a decade of being a bit of a rescuer. So I feel like I'm coming into true self really in the last few years. So I'm going to talk to you today about the 12 steps and the loving parent inner child work, because there was nothing written down about this. I got this from all of the people who came before me, the people who took the time to talk to me, the people's shares. And so I've sort of carried it and I've sponsored around it, and I hope that it will be of some use to you. So let's have a look here. One thing I want to say first off is we realize we cannot get out of this mess alone. And the reason we can't get out of this mess that we've gotten into when we come into these rooms is because we didn't get into this mess alone. It occurred in a family system. It's the disease of family dysfunction upon which all addictions and other behaviors rest. So it's really important to do this work with a group of people. One of the first things I did when I came into ACA was I got 13th step at my first meeting. Now, the 13th step isn't up there on the 12 steps list for a very good reason. It means when somebody decides you look good and it might be worth having a relationship with you. And just because it's your first meeting, they don't care, because some people come in and we have our survival tactics going great guns. And we find friends and we find flatmates and we find people to lend us or give us a car. I've seen people being given cars, give us jobs, lend us money, have relationships, all of these things. But you know what? This recovery is far too important for that. There's all sorts of people out there in the world we can be doing that stuff with. But many of those things led me out of the rooms again. I was quite ashamed of being in ACA. I remember some people coming up to me in the street who were from an ACA meeting back in the early 2000s. And I was with someone who didn't know I was in ACA. And I remember yelling at them to just back off. So there's a lot of dysfunction goes on. Luckily, I would run up and embrace people now. And I'm very proud to be in ACA. But the reverse side of the laundry list was something that was written up a few years in. We started off realizing that we'd been quite severely, badly traumatized and also not parented effectively by our parents. But that idea that we had become them, like I'm never going to be like my mum, I'm never going to be like my dad, it was really hard to come to see that that we are actually passing on something intergenerational. And I want to get into that because this is absolutely key. I see the first step and the 12th step actually returning, that the steps kind of return to one another. The first step and the 12th step are at the same place in a sense. We can't get out of this alone. And that's why we come to ACA. That's the first step. Our lives are becoming manageable. We come to a meeting. We say, I need somebody to just really listen to me and get it. And we either hear the 14 traits or the problem, which was what was from the West Coast of America, and the 14 traits were from the East Coast of America back in the day. And we go, that's me. That's my diagnosis. Good grief. I didn't know there was anybody else who had this like me, and we realize that we're part of a group. And the 12th step, we return there to this sense of, I'm part of a group, I can't go there, I can't do this alone. And we try to stay and be that person that other people were for us. And I've noticed that when I've left the rooms, my recovery always degrades. And normally, they say this with addiction, most certainly my family dysfunction stuff, has been waiting for me and has been waiting to continue on its journey into just devastating, ridiculous things. So I have the gift of having been out of this program several times. So we come in, and I always think the second part of the first step is the most important bit to get us over the doorway, which is that our lives have become unmanageable. We've tried absolutely everything on our own devices, and it's just fallen apart. And that certainly kept me in the rooms for a long time, that it was unmanageable. Didn't really understand that I was powerless over the effects of alcoholism and family dysfunction. I thought, no, probably I can fix my family, or I just need to come somewhere where people understand me. But in the end, I came to understand that there's a difference between helplessness and powerlessness. I was helpless as a child, but I most certainly am powerless as an adult. And our Serenity Prayer says it all. I was essentially trying to exert power over the entire world. Einstein says, there's two kinds of human beings. There's those that think that the universe is a theme park for you to go and explore and joyride in. And there's those of us who think it's the most terrifying place and can't believe that we've been born into a life. And how on earth could God have thought of something as difficult as this? Well, I know that most people who come into ACA, I've not heard anyone yet say that they think the universe is a theme park, but many people do feel that by the end, when their true self, which has always been there, right there, embryonically waiting for us to return, that we do start to play and have joy in our lives. And we do start to find that the universe is a place where things that used to baffle us don't baffle us anymore. But powerlessness is central, and the P word that kind of goes with powerlessness, with that first step, there's a P word that goes with it, and it's the word parent. And what I was asked to do when I came in for the first step was the bit of the loving parent work that I was asked to do was to retire my biological parents from the job. It wasn't get your own loving parent, Annie. It wasn't get in touch with the kids. It was retire your own biological parents from the job. Because as long as they were still in the job, and this took some time of sharing and distress and being heard and just getting it all out, until I retired them from the job, I was always going to be their child that had a difficult childhood. And I was going to miss out on year after year after year of adult life. And the day that I realized that I had actually missed out on more years of adult life under my own continuation of the family disease than I had missed out on childhood years was a stunning day for me. And on that day, I realized that I needed to start to invest in the adult me. And so I would go out the door every day and I would put on 3 overcoats, which wasn't great in summer, but most certainly in weather like we've got at the moment was pretty good. But luckily they were metaphorical ones. They weren't real. But I would actually imagine myself putting this on. First overcoat would be the adult overcoat. And then on top of that, I would put on my loving parent overcoat. And on top of that, I would put on my higher power overcoat. And I would literally, as I went out the door, do this. The brain believes you're putting things on when you do this. It's why we have God jars, because the brain doesn't know we're out here in the physical world. So if you write down, I just don't know what to do about how to get on with my son, and you write that down and you actually put it in a God jar, then the brain thinks you've literally moved it and put it somewhere else. So similarly, I put my adult coat on, my loving parent coat on, and my higher power coat on, and I would go out into the world, because I was not equipped for this world at all. During the 18 years of my life, I should have been parented through the developmental stages from 0 to 18. And each developmental stage, my parents were unable to do it. So I still had I could become inchoate with distress like a baby. I could be raging with the need to assert my identity and say no like a toddler. I could be desperately trying to learn how to move on from transitional objects like dogs and cats through to actually getting on with my peers like a 3 to 5 year old. I could be desperately trying to understand the social world around me like a 7 to 10-year-old. I could be trying to learn what my identity was, who I was in the world and what groups I fitted into like an 11 to 13-year-old. I could be trying to discover how to be a relational being and become a sexual and romantic being in my teenage years. And I couldn't do any of that. So there would be either a flooding of that behavior or not, because my parents never held space. And my parents were unable to basically let me do something which Claudia B brought into this program. Talk, trust, feel. And what Claudia B brought in was the don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. But while they weren't parenting me, and there's a good reason why they weren't, through these developmental stages, what they were doing was traumatizing me at every stage. So there was this kind of double whammy, which meant that I didn't have any of the skills of a 0 to 2-year-old that you develop. I didn't have any of the skills of a toddler to infant. I didn't have any of the skills all the way through. What I had was very, very distressed aspects of all of those parts of human development. I know that my teenager throughout my life has routinely hijacked my car and gone into road rage. And then after having completed the road rage incident, disappeared back down and left me, the adult, to deal with the fallout. So very distressed child states. And I came to understand fairly soon that I'd been sending the kids off to work. I'd been sending the kids to have relationships. I've been sending the kids on overseas holidays. I've been sending children out to do an adult's job. But funnily enough, every time I did something that was addictive or dissociative or attempt to get away from my pain, such as going out drinking, partying, finding somebody new to be in a relationship with, doing a geographical, I actually left the kids at home. So my kids have been both latchkey kids, my inner kids, and they've also been kids home alone. So I would leave them home alone to go out partying, to go out doing anything to get away from me. But I would also then send them off to work, where I would never be able to put up with authority figures in workplaces. And the teenager would normally come out while the adult me was somewhere resting at home, like the mum at home while the kids are going out and doing the shopping. This really strange inversion that they were always left home alone when I was doing my acting out dysfunctional behavior, but they were always out there in the world earning the money and looking good, going nowhere, while I was resting on my laurels as an adult. Just not, I'm not prepared to be an adult. It's really strange inversion. So, one of the things that is important is, while we have the powerless word in the steps, is that we have the parent word really, really, really early on in the adult child recovery aspect, because we've got a dual track recovery system in this program. It's quite beautiful. The two things go together. So the P word of parenting was important, that I retired my biological parents from the job. And I have to continually do that. There are always layers of the onion where I realize I'm still holding on to them being parents. They have never been parents. In actual fact, I remember the day I aged beyond them. My parents are about 13 or 14. So there was a point at which I did have some emotional sobriety beyond 13 and 14. And I could deeply recognize these people are not as old as I am. So why on earth would I expect them to parent me? If they're not going to parent me, who is? So apparently I had this inner critic, or this inner critical parent voice in my head. I didn't know that. Apparently it's the person who says, oh, you idiot, all the time, when you drop your keys or lock yourself out the car, or, you know, just say something unskillful. And I realized, yeah, that voice was in my head all the time. It was the condemning voice of my family, but it's not that simple. It was actually the condemning voice of myself growing up all through all the ages, because I was my family, it's intergenerational, the toxic shame. My parents have it, so that voice is in their heads all the time. My grandparents had it. So it's actually an ancestral voice. And in Gypsy terms, we call it like a cursed voice coming down the family line. It's a universal voice. It's a well-known voice that is criticizing. It's a voice that says, don't live, don't be true. You know, I will basically make sure you don't have a life. And I was just surviving that. So I was taught, again, this is around the brain, I was taught by people further along in the program than me, to every time the inner critical parent said something, that I was to flick it off. So it's like, oh, Annie, you idiot, you've dropped the keys again. And so, and I'd say it, and I still do sometimes, and I'd flick it off. And so one hand was coming across from one side of the body to the other. We don't have enough wiring in the brain between the two hemispheres because we've been traumatized and not parented enough. And so that would do that, the one part of the brain to the other, creating a network there. And then I'll put my hand on my heart, again, one part of the body to the other, and say, never mind, that wasn't so skillful. We'll try again tomorrow. And I practiced and practiced and practiced that. And I didn't believe it. I didn't feel it. I most certainly felt the critical parental voice. That was true. If you put me up to a lie detector test, it would have shown that I believed that voice. However, I faked it till I made it. And I practiced the inner loving parent voice. And now the voice that feels real to me is the one that says, oh, well, Annie, that wasn't so skillful. You accidentally said your surname at the beginning of that recorded thing. Never mind. It doesn't matter. So the P of parenting is there, and the P of power. The P of power is there in the steps, and the P of parenting is there in the adult child work. And another place where that P is for me, and remember, take what you like and leave the rest, because if some of this isn't resonating for you, that's absolutely okay. Just take the bits that work for you. So the next one was higher power. Okay. Get in touch with my outer adult. Every now and then I'll offer to do the dishes, and every now and then I'll listen to someone in a meeting rather than practicing what I'm going to say, which went on for years and years and years. So inner adult, yep, got that. Inner loving parent, got that. Higher power, major problem. Not liking this God stuff on the wall at all. There were these 12 steps that just seemed to wash backwards and forwards, and I didn't really know what they meant, but I basically wasn't going to be doing those, thank you very much, because they just looked a bit odd. And they just sat on the wall for a long time, waiting for me. So in actual fact, I did a lot of the adult child loving parent work before I even came to the steps, and then had to do a workaround. So the higher power for me in the end, it came back to that second part of the first step, which is that life had become unmanageable. And basically ACA is saying, it's an invitation. Would you like not to be in charge of the world? Are you tired of being in charge of the world? Of being hypervigilant, of being aware of everything, picking up everything, everyone's emotions, being codependent, not knowing where you start and other people finish. Would you like to not be in charge of the world anymore? And I was tired, really tired. Yes, I didn't want to be in, because it wasn't working out very well. So I did retire myself from that job, and I would pick it up every now and then. But the serenity prayer really stuck for me, and I did understand there was only one person I could change, and that was going to be me. So the higher power became the group and its literature initially. It wasn't the fellowship. It was the group and its literature. And for a while, if the literature said do something, I would just say, how high do you want me to jump? If you say jump, I'll jump. But there were only three identity documents. But the great thing about this fellowship was that it had a different literature approach, which was that you could use literature from elsewhere. So good job, really, before 2006, because we didn't have a big red book till then. We didn't have a steps book till 2007. So when it was the group and its literature. Now it would probably be the literature more than the group for me, because the literature has been filtered through lots of different levels. But I did learn that ACA had something to keep returning to. And it said I could take what I like and leave the rest. And then over time, the fellowship itself, as I learned more about it, and remember the internet, I was actually working at the time, interviewing someone who was inventing the information superhighway at university, which turned out to be the internet one day. So I certainly wasn't doing anything on the internet initially. So the fellowship would be really difficult for me to interact with in the early days, because there simply was no way of communicating with it from a different country. And so when we could and had the internet, had ways of connecting, and had started these talks started coming out of America. And then there were speakers who had actually come out from America and talked to us. And over time, the fellowship became my higher power. And then little by little, for me and for me only, there actually was a spiritual higher power, which seemed to link back to something I'd been connecting with in early childhood that had always been there for me and that was quite cultural for me. So anyway, I did eventually, you know, I made my decision to turn my will and my life over to a higher power, which was the meeting, and to keep turning up. And I did several 90 and 90s, which is absolutely impossible to do in ACA until probably this last few years, where you can get online and do stuff on Zoom. And there's been meetings at lunchtimes, often 7 days of the week. So 90 and 90s, doing 90 meetings in 90 days. But I did that, and I did it by going to open AA meetings and Al-Anon meetings, as well as going to ACA meetings. And that for me was hugely important, to basically turn up again and again and again, maybe once a day, twice a day, in a 12-step space. And I could talk about steps 4 and 5 and making a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And that is actually one that that's not Tony A's, you've heard what the Tony A's one is, and then admitted to God, to ourselves and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. But they're ones that we actually do quite a lot of talking about in ACA, so I'm not going to cover them in great depth with what I'm going to say. However, with step one, we very early on, and it feels like really confronting when we look at the yellow book, the laundry list yellow book, it seems really confronting that the first few questions are about militaristic parents and hypochondriac parents and alcoholic parents and sexually abusive parents. It's like, I'm not sure I want to do these steps. This is all pretty hard. But what it's trying to do is basically with that genogram, and I think there are gentler ways to do it, but it is how that book is at the moment. We're trying to find out the family roles, because in actual fact, I didn't realize this, but I actually wasn't a human being at all. I was a collection of reactions and an ego tied up with a name on top. And I was living out roles. My true self is how I'm human. And so the family roles, if you look at the family roles, they're hero, scapegoat, lost child, clown and mascot, etc. But then you've also got the family dysfunction types. And those are, you know, the alcoholic, the perfectionist, the militaristic, the emotionally unwell, sexually abusive. So the family dysfunction types, basically, if you throw a human being through those family dysfunction types, they grow up in a family like that. They'll come out the other end of the mincer with a cluster of different family roles. And so for a while I was the hero, which meant that, you know, it's academically did quite well for my family. And so that meant that we looked good. We were going nowhere, but we looked good. And my sister was the scapegoat for a long time, which meant that everything that was wrong with the family could be put on her. So this is projecting. This is really important. Projecting one individual, normally the alcoholic, in actual fact, that scapegoat will normally turn into the alcoholic. They're normally the most sensitive person in the family system, so they're just unable to fake that things are going okay in this family. And so family just smells it somehow and goes, yep, you'll do for us, projecting everything that is wrong about us onto you, because then we'll be okay and we'll survive, because this family unit is attempting to survive. I was a hero, made us look good. We're going to go somewhere in the next generation. And then for most of my adult life, I've been the scapegoat instead. And that's been a really strange thing to experience. I was also the lost child. So hero, me, workaholic, very physically ill often, pretty controlling person, not much fun to be around, pretty arrogant, and didn't experience an awful lot of shame because I projected. Scapegoat me, so that was me growing up. Scapegoat me, various addictions, normally process addictions, a bit promiscuous, definitely had a chip on my shoulder. I would play that role out in jobs and relationships and then burn out because I was basically faking who I was. Lost child, I would not really share real opinions, my real opinions, and get involved in really relating to anybody at all. And I didn't really feel needed as a person, but I always knew I was wanted for the things I could do for others. And it felt like being eaten alive. And I did do a bit of the clown and the mascot as well, I must say. And that was a way of almost being like a magnet for pain. The more I was acting up and acting the fool, the more in pain I was. And I did a little bit of that last night at a group thing, and then burst into tears, which was totally appropriate. I wasn't being a drama queen. And it was really interesting to see how that was, that I built up a surfeit of pain and then was just expressing it. And it felt okay. So those family roles that come out of the end of the Mensa of the family dysfunction types are really important for us to understand. We sit on a drama triangle, essentially, of victim, persecutor, and rescuer, and we play out those, all three of them we play out. And in actual fact, really, at the end of the day, all there is a victim. So that if we're persecuting, we're really just projecting out into somebody else our own victimhood. And normally when we're rescuing, we're doing it from the position of a victim. I need you to want you, like me. I need you to like me. You need to be rescued by me. I need you to be rescued by me. Or we're doing it as a persecutor. I'm going to take you hostage. I'm going to rescue the hell out of you. And you're going to do what I say. So there really isn't a rescuer at all. There's just a persecutor and a victim. And then really there isn't even a persecutor. There's just a victim playing out survival stuff. So that those are the interactive behaviors between us as we play out our family dysfunction roles, which we get from having been through the upbringing through the family dysfunction types, whatever kind of family we got, whether it was militaristic or deeply, crazily out of control, in whatever way it was. So having learned all of that, I discovered I actually didn't have much of a self at all. It was false self. All of that was what made up a false self. And I needed to map it. I needed to map it really well. And that was the fourth step. And there've been a variety of fourth steps in actual fact. And I love the fact that that's okay in this program. And then admitting it to my higher power, whoever or whatever that was, and to another human being, not so that I could just confess it to someone and show that I was prepared to say some of these deepest, darkest things, but in actual fact, so that another connected person could hear me. And here we come back to Claudia B's, don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. Essentially, as young beings coming into the world and learning language, for which we always have the scaffolding in our brains, Noam Chomsky says, and I totally agree with him, when we feel something, is actually in the early days, it's an emotion, it's not a feeling at all. And I remember going to counseling and they'd go, how do you feel? And I go, I don't know. Well, of course I didn't know, because you actually don't know language until other people are interacting with you. And you most certainly, any literacies that we have, we don't know the language of feelings at all either. Our families and our communities teach us that. But what we do have is emotions. And that comes from the Latin emovere, to move away from. And so emotions are things like anger and terror and fear. And even like massive excitement as well. So I would, as a small child, want to move away from things that made me distressed. And so what normally happens when a child does that is you move towards something that's you're safely attached to, which is usually a parental figure or caregiver figure or siblings, etc. So I would try to move towards these attachment figures, try to build attachment. With my emotions, trying to move away from something distressing. And what would usually happen is that I certainly wasn't looking for a safe person. You don't when you're in that state. I don't know if any of you have ever been in a major earthquake or we've had mosque shootings here. You literally go for whatever attachment figure you can find. Normally a human one, and then you go down the scale from there and you'll find it in a bottle or Netflix or whatever, but we will attach to something. And so as a small mite, I would try to attach and I would move towards probably the safest human I could think of in my family system, which wasn't that easy. It's a pretty traditional alcoholic, violent family home. Trying to move towards it with this emotion. And I would be talking and I've seen small children do it as well. They're talking, they're using words right away, really early on. And so I would try to talk and only then I would try to find someone to trust. And I would occasionally find it in my grandmother. And then she would say, oh, dear, sounds like you're upset that X, Y, or Z happened. Oh, that must have been difficult. You must have felt lonely when X, Y, or Z happened. Or, oh, did you feel rejected when little so-and-so did this, that, or the other to you? So as I came with these big emotions of anger, distress, fear, I met this trusting attachment figure who then spoke to me and refined for me what that big emotion really was, which was contextualized to the moment and the place, the people, places, and things with which I was interacting at that very moment. And they became feelings, nuanced feelings that were the right size. Yes, it's a shame when your little friend doesn't want to play with you or invite you to a birthday party, but it's not such a big emotion anymore because the secure attachment figure of grandma has just worked you through it. So I talked my emotion and came zooming towards her. I found someone to trust, and then I learned to feel rather than emote. The dysfunctional family system says, don't talk. Don't you dare start moving towards someone, trying to find someone to be an attachment for you. You know we'll give you something to cry about. So you will not find someone to trust, and so you will not be taught how to feel. Because people often say, why is it that way around? Why did Claudia B. do that? Why did she say, don't talk, don't trust, don't feel? Well, she said, it's not that I have a feeling. I need to find someone to trust so that I can talk about it. And that's what we often think it is, you know, as adults. Oh, I've got a feeling. I need to find someone to talk so I can talk to so that I can, that I trust so I can talk about it. No, the little us is just screaming straight out of the traps, saying whatever words they've got. You'll see your children and distressed adults just going around a crowd trying to find that person that is going to look them in the eye and attach to them and say, I'm here, I'm holding space for you, you can trust me in this moment. And then you let it all out, and then they, in interaction with you, get the context, get the people, places, and things, settle it down, the emotions become small, and a feeling happens, and we feel better. And this is why, you know, using the telephone is important. Finding the people who are really working the program, sticking with the winners, is hugely important because they are the people who can hold space. Other people are going to amplify the drama. They're going to celebrate your emoting rather than supporting you to find, to parent yourself towards having feelings. And so big dramas can occur in the rooms because people are supporting the emoting and the emotions. I had massive emotions. It was really difficult often to sit in the rooms, difficult to be in relationships, etc. But, you know, I mapped out my family. I mapped out my part in it. I found another human being to share that with. And the really important part of that was getting past toxic shame. So sometimes it feels really good to say, oh, I was bad in this way, I was bad in that way. And it's what we know. But in actual fact, being heard by somebody and being held still as someone of value afterwards. And certainly hearing fifth steps, it's hugely important to hold space and have absolutely positive regard and say really upfront, if there is anything that you think you need to take to someone else other than me, then we can work out who that person is. If there's a couple of things, I've heard pretty much everything over the years. I've heard about murder. I've heard about all manner of things. And so it's really important to find the right person for that fifth step. And you're in charge of your own recovery. We are the authors of our own recovery. It has to be the right person. It doesn't have to be only one person. And when I've done the fifth step with people, we actually put out chairs, and there's a chair for God. And at the end of it, I asked the person to go and sit in the chair that was God's chair. Because after the fifth step, this is the beginning of the move away from the false self. We've just mapped out the whole false self. We've arrived at the end of the fifth step. Go and sit in the chair that we put out for God in the room. Because at this point in time, there's a ritual here. You are about to start to emerge into your true self. Because step 6 and 7 are all about the true self. And we often gloss over them. It's like, oh, I'm not sure about those ones. Kind of like, I've done my 4th and 5th, and I really want to get on and do that amends thing, or I don't, or I'm going to do a big recovery swerve. I most certainly did a recovery swerve at the end of the 3rd one. No way I was doing that moral inventory. It might kill me. But then I did it. And then it was like big swerve. I'm not doing all of that making amends thing. So the recovery swerves would happen. But in actual fact, if we don't do 6 and 7, and this is just my humble opinion, take what you like and leave the rest. If we don't do 6 and 7 really, really, really well, we need the overcoats that are 6 and 7 for us to go out and really do 8 and 9 really well. And there's this phrase in the 12-step fellowships, which is drop the rocks. And we're carrying a massive amount of rocks around with us. And they do this at the Betty Ford Center. They do it with the children's program. They get the children there to get big rocks and paint on them words which really sum up how it is growing up with addictive parents. And they put these rocks in baskets and then they carry them around. And it's like, these are really heavy things. Do you want to drop the rocks? So now this is something that I had a sponsor get me to do. I had to go through my fourth step and look at it and see, could I see out of all of the aspects of the different things that I'd written up for my fourth step, what my defects of character would be. We could see the laundry list traits quite clearly in that. And so the laundry list traits would be that I was a para alcoholic, you know, had addictive stuff. I was codependent. I was a reactor, definitely, rather than an actor. I would definitely judge myself harshly and other people. I'd stuff my feelings down. I'd be afraid of people and authority figures, but I also was one. I'd confuse love and pity. I'd take people hostage as well because I was trying to do the other side of the laundry list while I was at it. Live addictive life, addicted to excitement, be an approval seeker, but also make sure lots of people were actually coming to me for approval too. Be self-sacrificial, be terrified of abandonment, be frightened of angry people, and live my life from the viewpoint of a victim, and also a bit of a persecutor from the position of a victim. So I could look at my fourth and see all those things and basically go, okay, anything else that's in my fourth now is essentially defects of character. So here's where this huge mapping of my fourth was really important. And also the sponsor would be helping me in the fifth write these things down and actually note what the defects of character were, because I was about to do my defects of character work in the sixth and seventh step. And so we've got it on the laundry list, the yellow laundry list workbook. We've got the fruit of the tree of family dysfunction, which is the defects of character. And there'd be things like mistrust, feeling superior, procrastination, greed, pettiness, envy, lust, perfectionism, isolation, dishonesty, being judgmental, and self-centeredness. And so write all of these things down. And it's all feeling a bit heavy. But the great thing with six and seven is like arriving at the top of the hill, arriving at just at the top of the hill, because everything from that point onwards in 12-step work is going to be cruising down the hill. And so we would look at these defects of character that we'd written down, all of the things like the seven deadly sins, et cetera, and more, and basically distill them down to three upon which all the others sat. And I'm grateful that my sponsor got me to do only three, because I didn't know what was coming next. And I had to then go and find three big rocks and write down on these three big rocks the three major character defects that I had upon which all others sat. And so I did, painted them and put the word on, you know, the three different words on. And then, great sponsor, I had to put one in my bed, one in the chair I mostly sat on at home, and one in my car seat. And every day I had to move a rock off my car seat, a rock off the seat that I sat in, and a rock out of my bed before I could go to sleep, sit and watch the TV, or drive to work or anywhere else. And this went on and on and on. And she said, "You let me know when you're ready to not have those rocks anymore in your life." And I was so surprised that I kept them for a long time and kept moving them to one side. I didn't realize how attached I was to this millstone around my neck while I was drowning in the ocean. Eventually I said, don't need that one in the car seat anymore. Eventually don't need that one in the bed anymore. And it felt humble in actual fact. And that's funny because that's the first word of the seventh step. But pretty humble. I don't want these anymore. And there were so many conversations I'd have to myself about why these character defects have become so important. They felt like a life raft, like a life buoy, and they were actually a millstone. And so then she said, "Okay, good. All right. Well, I wrote down the amends you need to make out of the fourth step, you know, when we're doing the fifth. So now what I'd like is for you to list these amends under those three character defects. Which amends goes with that character defect? Which amends goes with that one? And which amends goes with that one?" And that's how you'll do them. You'll do all the ones that go with that character defect first, and this, that, and the other. Even though there might be some difficulty, I might have to go back to the same town three times because they come under different character defects. I thought, okay, all right. I don't mind. I'm liking this bit now because I get to move around and do stuff. No, we're not finished yet. How are you going to do it if you haven't asked God to remove these character defects? I don't know. So this is the point in the steps where we get to the top of the mountain. She said, "Get a rucksack, and put those rocks in it and walk to the top of a mountain. So I did. And she said, put them down at the top of that mountain and put your arms up and ask God humbly, not just to remove them, but to give you the character assets that they really are. This is the false self letting go, these character qualities. In the false self, they are defects. In the true self, they are assets. So if you're a judgmental person, let the defect go, let the false self go, because judgmental becomes discernment for the true self. It is a character asset. The universe is made up of binaries and it doesn't like vacuums. Asking God to let go of your character defects and just let them go without something else coming in its place, it's a transmuting. It just can't be done. It's very, very hard, and I've seen people try to do it. So again, take what you like and leave the rest. This is just how it was for me. And so I had spent some time thinking about what the character asset version of these three major character defects upon which everything else stood were. I went up to the top of the mountain. I put my hands up and I said, God, please remove, you know, I said it's step seven prayer, please remove these character defects and please give me in your time the character asset version of these. This is the moment in which my false self is coming to an end and my true self is beginning. And then I walked down the mountain and left them up there. And she said, you can go back in your mind to that mountain anytime you want, anytime you need to, take yourself back there. And I've done that many a time. And so then we came to steps 8 and 9. The list had been done, refined the list, and now the list was in three parts, but now with the intention of your character asset, this beautiful character asset of discernment that you have, because I thought I was making amends around it coming off the list that was sitting on the top of judgment. But no, now with these beautiful character asset that you have always had, but it's been distorted by survival mechanisms, this beautiful character asset of discernment, Annie, go and make those amends. And when you've done that, come back. We'll talk about it. And then under the beautiful character asset that you are asking God to cultivate in you, of whatever the others were, go and make the amends on that list. And as part of that amends, part of the loving parent and a child work that I did, I also went back to places. Sometimes I had to do it in my mind, otherwise literally geographically, and went and took the hand of a younger me and walked them out of a specific location. I've done it in McDonald's in Queen Street in Auckland. And I said, come on, you don't need to be here anymore. And remember, the mind doesn't know that we're out here in the world. So as far as the brain's concerned, I literally am walking into the past and I'm taking that child by the hand or that young adult by the hand, because by the time I was doing it, I had some stuff to do for young adult me, and walked them out of these places and did guided meditations and other things for younger me until all of my children were with me, the parent, the real parent, and none of them were left behind. So then we arrive at steps 10, 11, 12. And step 10 is really a fourth and a fifth, isn't it? And an eighth and a ninth daily. It's just the tidy up, the mop up. And I've done it even when I've been going back through a fourth and a fifth. Different aspects of me, the fragmented, the dissociative me, have had to come back and integrate. And sometimes there need to be a mini fourth and fifth around something and an eighth and ninth. And I know how to do it now. And I know where the mountains are, you know, I know where to go to Hamner Springs and walk up to the top of Conical Hill. And the 11th for me is step 2 and 3 daily, turning my will and my life over. And there's a little bit of that 7th step as well at the top of the mountain. And that 12th step, it's a return to the understanding that I didn't get into this mess alone. I'm not going to get out of this mess alone. And my recovery needs me here. It needs me here doing this work for others and never for a minute thinking that I have made it, that I've got something to share beyond my story, and that others should take what they like, leave the rest, and use it in whatever way they, as the author of their recovery, their own recovery, can use it. So I think I'll leave it there. We move out of the drama triangle into being pretty square for a while. We've got the three sides of that drama triangle still, the victim, the persecutor, and the rescuer, but there becomes a sober side to a square, to the square us. And then one day it becomes a circle. And that feels like a really spiritual thing to me. We're in sobriety. And when people are dysfunctional and they leave us and things are unfair, there just seems to be a really strong groundedness in the belly that says, it's okay. God's got it covered. I'm my own loving parent. I never gave that job away to anyone else. For very long anyway, in recovery, that my secure attachment is now utterly interior inside me and with God, and that my inner paramedic and my inner oxygen tank are there, which means that while I do need to reach out to others and be part of a community and be connected and be part of a fellowship, I know that I have all of the aspects within me to get through whatever comes. And that is because I was given the gift of interweaving this dual track system of both the loving parent work and the 12 steps of this fellowship together. And it is a beautiful journey. And I hope that all of you find your way along it. Thank you.
Thank you, Annie. Please join with me in thanking Annie.
Thank you, Annie.
Thanks, Annie.
Thank you, Annie. Really appreciate it.
To close off the recording, let us all unmute and say the Serenity Prayer together. Who loves us?
God, may the serenity Amen.
Thank you for joining us in our recording.
Thank you so much, everyone. I'm really